Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And our guest today is responsible for a whole lot of movies, a lot of very big, successful, much loved movies. And somehow almost all of them have Batman in the title. Let's welcome Michael Uslan. Michael, hello.
Hi, Len. Hi, Jesse. I'm so happy to be here with you guys. Thank you.
Well, we're happy to have you. After all, you are the boy who loved Batman.
I will take that appellation in the name and honor of everybody who ever was a Batman comic book or superhero fan.
Well, that's very generous of you. But you are the boy who not only loved Batman, but got a hold of Batman. And I'm going to ask you to reveal that in just a moment. That is also the name of your book, your memoir.
Correct.
Which I didn't know was now available in an updated edition.
It is, and recorded the audiobook version of it, and the audiobook version is now on sale, and that was a lot of fun.
Wow. Well, I mean, I'll tell you, my dad, for the first time, his most recent book, he did an audiobook. He's never done one before. It's tough.
It is a grueling process.
Yeah.
You know who my inspiration was? When I was growing up in New Jersey, during the weekday nights, while I was lying in bed and my folks thought I was asleep, I used to listen to Gene Shepard.
Gene Shepard. But he could talk for hours.
Hours. But this audio, it took like 8 hours for me to record it.
Yeah.
So I
feel your pain.
Yeah.
I just went in thinking about Gene Shepard and went in with his level of energy,
yeah,
his level of excitement about it, and made it a fun thing.
Wow. Well, congratulations. As I say, it's something my dad had never done before. And it was a different muscle to flex.
Yes.
And it takes, I think we talked about this at the time, but the biggest thing is my dad's used to reading 30-second or 1 minute.
I'm used to doing voiceover
stuff,
tonight, you know, little short bursts.
And to then have to do that for hours.
And I'm not an actor. I'm not a trained actor.
No.
I don't have voice training. I don't use my diaphragm correctly.
You really don't.
And so this was a workout, yeah. But I don't want to sound like I'm whining.
No, it was just
complaining.
It was just different. And that's, I'm sure for you, you know, getting in there and doing it, also reading your own words.
It was an incredible experience. It was a great way to honor my parents,
sure,
all my teachers, my mentors, the people in my life who got me to Batman and allowed me to follow my passion in life, persevere through a long period of time when everything looked dark and horrible. And that's really what it took. And this is a way to just honor them and be part of my legacy.
Yeah, for sure. Where in New Jersey? I'm not going to say what exit. Where in New Jersey?
Well, you could say I grew up at 105, Asbury Park area.
Sure. And,
it was the greatest place in the world to grow up.
Yeah.
We had access to the greatest music scene in America.
Right.
As a kid, I go into Asbury Park. I saw The Doors, Janis Joplin, Led Zeppelin, Joe Cocker. You name them. They showed up at Asbury Park. It was really magical.
Incredible. That's the thing is, it's funny because people make jokes about New Jersey. I've learned that. But because my dad had the same experience you did, he grew up in Teaneck, which is just
a really idyllic looking.
I call it Jersey Light.
It is. You know, he went into the city all the time. It's like, so you both had the best New Jersey.
Really did. Having been in this business 46 years, yeah. Like you just meant, when I started in the business and went to meetings in Hollywood and they heard I was from New Jersey, I was subject to every Johnny Carson. But as soon as The Sopranos debuted, they began to back off and treat me with great respect.
That's
the changing point.
Very
God bless you, Sopranos. Thank you for giving respect.
Thank you, David Chase. Okay. All right. So Michael, rather than tease the subject anymore, tell us how, and then we'll wind backwards and hear about your lifelong, almost fanatical love of comic books and your ascension to the ranks of academics. And the first person really who's credited with giving comic books the respect at a collegiate level that they always deserve. But first, how did you align yourself with Batman?
Oh my God. All right. So getting my whole past out and just getting to the heart of the matter. When I was teaching the world's first college accredited course on comic books at Indiana University, it got a lot of publicity. I was doing radio and TV talk shows. I didn't teach one class that wasn't filled with television cameras and reporters, the biggest one being John Chancellor, NBC News at the time. And about 2 weeks after this barrage of publicity started, my phone rings. I get two calls on the same day. First call, this exuberant voice. Hi, is this Mike Uslan? Yeah. Hi, I'm Mike. This is Stan Lee from Marvel Comics in New York City, which I call my burning bush moment. God. And he said, Mike, everywhere I look, I'm seeing you on TV. I'm reading about you in newspapers. What you're doing is great for the comic book industry. How can I help you? That was the moment Stan changed from my idol to my mentor, ultimately to my friend, to my creative partner. And then my son, David, and I were two of the producers of his memorial at Grauman's Chinese Theater. 2 hours later, the phone rings. Mr. Uslan, my name's Saul Harrison. I'm vice president of DC Comics in New York. We've been listening to you on the radio, reading about you in magazines. You are a very innovative young man. We'd like to fly you to New York City and discuss ways to work together.
What year is this?
1971 into two. And so I flew to New York. They offered me a job. They put me on retainer when I went back to school. And I worked summers at DC Comics. And without regaling you with a dozen stories that are in my book, I got to become a DC Comics professional writer, thanks to an editor, Denny O'Neill, who gave me my break. And the first thing I ever wrote was The Shadow, which was the character most directly influencing the creation of Batman back in 39. And then
because of his dual identity
and his darkness and his mysteriousness.
Okay.
And Bill Finger, the co-creator of Batman, told me point blank when I met him and sat with him when I was 13 years old, he told me the creation of Batman and made it very clear how heavy an influence the Shadow was on him and on Bob Kane. Bob even swiped a lot of artwork from the Shadow pulps. So
I'm going to do an intervention here. For those of you who don't know, The Shadow was a wonderful creation by a man named Walter Gibson, who first appeared in a series of pulp magazine stories. And then to even reach an even wider audience as a radio show, a very popular radio show. And the Shadow's alter ego was a man named Lamont Cranston, who had the ability to cloud men. Sorry, I'm blowing the line. Who had the ability to cloud men's minds, and who had a girl Friday slash girlfriend named Margot Lane, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
And I got to know Walter. I got to work with him. And every time I write The Shadow, whether it's for comics or graphic novels, I always pretend Walter's looking over my shoulder, which is great. He was Houdini's last living associate. And stories about Houdini. We could do a whole hour just on what Walter told me. So 2 weeks after I hand in my shadow script, I'm walking down the hall at DC, and who's coming toward me but Julie Schwartz, arguably the most important editor in the history of comics. He's the guy who returned Batman to his dark roots in the 1970s. He gave us Justice League, Silver Age Flash, Green Lantern, Hawkman, Atom. And I'm walking down the hall, he goes, "Hey, kid," and my hair is down to my shoulders. I've got some kind of weird t-shirt on. He goes, "I read your shadow script." I said, "You did?" He goes, "Yeah, it didn't stink." I said, "Oh, thank you, Julie. Thank you so much." He said, "How'd you like to take a shot at writing Batman?" And I started writing Batman in Detective Comics, which was a dream come true for me. Mm. And that dream I had since I was 8 comes true. And I panicked. I said, "Oh my God, I have no dream anymore. I need a new dream. What's it going to be?" And in 10 minutes, I remembered back, Len, you might remember this, a cold winter day in 1966, a day every Batman fan had been waiting for months, the premiere of the Batman TV series.
You bet.
And it comes on. The animation was kind of Bob Kane, Jerry Robinson. It was in color. Somebody was spending a lot of money on the sets. The car was cool. 20 minutes in, I go, "Oh no, it's a comedy. They're making fun of Batman. The whole world thinks Batman's a joke." Mm. And that night in our basement den, I made a vow. Just like Bruce Wayne had once made a vow. Except he did it over the bloody bodies of his parents in the street. My parents were safe upstairs in the kitchen. But I said, "Somehow, someday, I'm going to show the world the true Batman. The one created in 1939 as a creature of the night stalking deeply disturbed villains." And that was the night this whole thing started. I won the trust of Sol Harrison at DC Comics. He realized I was a comic book historian. I was a comic book college professor. I was a comic book DC writer. And that I loved these characters. And I knew all about their creators. And then when I went to Sol, he had become president of DC. I said, "Sol, I want to buy the rights to Batman. I want to start making dark and serious Batman movies and show the whole world he's not this pop-belly, pow-zap-wham funny guy." And Sol was like a second father to me. He said, "Michael, for God's sake, don't do this. I don't want to see you lose all your money." He said, "Don't you understand? Since Batman went off the air on TV, the brand is as dead as a dodo." That's a quote. Mm. He said, "No one's interested in Batman anymore." I said, "But Sol, nobody's ever seen a dark and serious comic book movie before. This could be like a whole new form of entertainment."
Yeah.
And then he looked like the poster from Home Alone. He goes, "Is there any way I can talk you out of this?" And I said, "No." He said, "All right, Schmoozel, come on in." And it was a 6-month negotiation. I found the greatest partner. He was my dad's age, Ben Melnicker, a legend at MGM. And on October 3rd, 1979, signed the papers, we paid the money, and I bought the rights to Batman. And people say, "How can a kid in his 20s buy the rights to Batman? It's impossible. It's inconceivable." But in the context of its time, I was the only person on the planet Earth who showed up.
Right.
And that's the unglamorous answer.
And we have to set this in this much context. That at that time, there had not been comic superhero movies for grownups. The first one was just preceded your transaction, and that was the Christopher Reeve Superman movie. And it was one of a kind. It was one of a kind. And everybody who saw that movie or reviewed that movie had to refer back to the George Reeves television series, because that was the previous live incarnation of Superman, you know, on film. But that was a kid's TV show. Very, very different. So the Richard Donner directed Superman movie was a one-off, or that's how people thought of it. We didn't know that the producers had really produced a two-off, but that's another story. That's
it is, but nobody has more respect for Dick Donner than I do. I love the guy. It was amazing. What an amazing talent. Just on every level, he was a great, great human being. With Superman 1, Krypton was very serious. Smallville was very serious. Yet the second he puts on that costume, it kind of lightens up completely. Mm. So nobody had ever taken it as the costume, as a guy in a costume, deeply into the world of dark and serious before. And that became the mission of Tim Burton, a young genius. To me, there were two geniuses who made it happen for 89. And that was Tim Burton and my dear friend, Anton Furst, who was our production design. What those two guys did, they revolutionized Hollywood. It would never be the same again. They revolutionized the comic book industry. And they changed the world culture's perception of comic books, superheroes, and supervillains. And Len, I always like to say it was Tim Burton who had what I call the big idea. He came to me one day. At the time, I was having a meltdown when I heard he wanted to hire Michael Keaton to play Batman. I said, but he doesn't have a square jaw. And I started to whine and cry and melt. And he said, Michael, if we're going to do the world's first ever dark and serious comic book superhero movie and want everybody to buy into it without getting unintentional laughs from the audience, this movie can't be about Batman. And then I just crumbled into a heap. He said, no, this movie has to be about Bruce Wayne. The big idea.
The big idea.
This is what opened the door to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Look at the Iron Man. They should really be called Tony Stark.
Right.
The Spider-Man movie should really be called Peter Parker. This was the big idea. And then he had a corollary. He said, from the opening frames, Gotham City must be the third most important character in this piece. Because if we can't get the audience to suspend its disbelief and believe in Gotham, they'll never believe a guy getting dressed as a bat and fighting a guy who looks like the Joker. And that's where Anton first came in. And that was magic.
And literally, talk about a game changer. I mean, if the game is making successful movies, then you reinvented the ideal of a commercially successful movie.
But even if you look at it now, if you watch it now, it still looks, and I say strange in the best way, it's still jarring. You know, how often does a character remain scary over time? You know, a lot of times we sort of go, oh, all right, when I was a kid, that frightened me, not anymore. Penguin is still terrifying. Like in that movie, it's still, there's a lot of whimsy, which is obviously Tim Burton's thing. But it's scary. And there are a lot of pieces to it that are still very scary. And Batman
Returns.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely true. And with Batman 89 holds up. When you watch it, you don't feel like you're watching an 80s movie.
Mm.
And again, my credit goes to Tim, Anton, and Bob Ringwood, who did the costuming. They mixed past, present, and future together.
Right.
They mixed it up with the technology, with the dress. And so now today, when you see it, you can't focus. You can't get, it's not period. It's right. Not 80s.
Amazing. I got to interview Michael Keaton at the Santa Barbara Film Festival, where they do one night every year during their award season, where I sit on stage and review a star's or a director's great career with the, you know, film clip highlights.
For 2 hours.
And I asked Michael Keaton if he was aware. I remember this is before the internet. You remember this. But before the internet, when they announced him that he had been cast in this part, the public went nuts. They went nuts and they were heard. There were no emails. There were no social media outlets for them, but they made that furor known. And I asked Michael Keaton if he was aware of it. Well, it seems he was in the middle of a child custody battle with his wife. And so what he was doing was he was commuting back and forth from the filming in London to somewhere here in the States, I guess the West Coast, to spend the weekend with his son. And he looked at the Wall Street Journal, where for years, instead of headshots, they've had line drawings. Right. Of the principal subject of the articles. And he saw himself in a line drawing and said, what's this? And that's how he found out. Because the Wall Street Journal wrote an article about the opposition or the fan opposition or maybe the word is outcry, outcry to him being cast. And it affected him.
Yeah.
He said that he showed up back on the set that Monday, his confidence shaken.
Yeah.
And he had to overcome that.
Well, hey, look at, I mean, so Robert Pattinson just played Batman. And initially when he was cast, everybody did what they do. And oh no, he's going to be terrible. And then everyone I have spoken to, especially my beloved nerds, my husband included, all said he was fantastic. He was a great Batman.
This is a pattern that continually repeats since 1988. Yeah. And the studio would throw me out in front of the pack with their torches and pitchforks. Mm-hmm. I was one of them, and I came through the ranks, and they knew me as a fanboy who was making good.
Right.
And not as a corporate suit who was reading a PR release written by somebody.
Right.
So I was out there to do damage control.
Right.
Because the reaction was, okay, you know, at a Comic-Con, God, my Q&A, Uslan. But at that moment, it was not Michael. Uslan, you got Mr. Mom playing Batman, directed right. by the guy who directed Pee-wee's Big Adventure. What the? And that's where it started. Happened again with Heath Ledger.
Mm.
Huge outcry. Are you guys kidding me? You're hiring a gay cowboy to play the Joker? Huh.
Jesus.
He could destroy this role for the rest of eternity. And of course, each time, once they actually see the picture,
right.
it's like they never want anyone else to play the role.
Right.
It was the same with Ben Affleck. It was the same with Robert Pattinson. I mean, it just kind of goes on and on. And I say to the fans, I say, everybody, listen, you not only have a right, you have a responsibility to air your opinions and let the studio know. But after you see it.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. We always go back. We always go back to Harlan Ellison. You're entitled to your informed opinion. And that's what you want to yell is it's like, see, if you hate it after you see it, then we can have a conversation. But you can't hate it till you see it.
Exactly right. It got serious with Joker.
Mm.
And just before the movie was coming out, there was a growing outcry from people and organizations that had not seen the movie. Oh, it's going to glorify gun violence. It's going to glorify killing. It's going to, and everybody was told to shut up, and I couldn't. And I got out in the public eye, and I defended Todd Phillips, and I defended that picture. And I said, it's the polar opposite.
Yeah.
It is the polar opposite. He is taking the lens, which is what cinema is supposed to do when it's at its best, and holding it up as a mirror in front of society, our society that's been polarized, that no longer talks with each other, talks at each other, and talks about that there are consequences for that. And if we continue to ignore mental health issues, that's tied to gun violence, and we better wake up as a society. It was the polar opposite thing. And then when they saw the picture, it was embraced, and the picture wound up doing $1.1 billion just at the theatrical box office. Todd Phillips, another genius. Christopher Nolan, another genius.
Now, what I find fascinating is how not only Batman, but other characters, you mentioned Spider-Man before, are so easily malleable that they can be reborn. Their stories can be rewritten. I thought Christopher Nolan and his brother did a fantastic job in Batman Begins of reinventing the origin story of Bruce Wayne and Batman. I didn't think that was possible, but they pulled it off.
I think with Chris's Dark Knight trilogy, first of all, I claim it's one movie in three acts. Mm-hmm. It is not three acts. It is one of the most beautifully structured movies. It's incredible how it's structured. Every character arc is smooth as silk. Every setup has a payoff. Every payoff has a setup. It's just gorgeous in the craft of making that movie. But when you walk out of a Christopher Nolan Batman movie, you no longer have to say, gee, that was a great comic book movie. You could now say that was a great film. And yeah. He like elevated the entire art form of making comic book movies into something it wasn't exactly before then.
Are you, I mean, I'm sure you get asked this constantly. Are you allowed to say, do you have a favorite Batman? Like, is there an actor that you like best?
But I'll answer that once I tell you who my favorite child is.
Sure. I'm an only child, so he doesn't have that problem.
He may have a weight on that. Each one for its time.
Sure.
Each one for its time. I don't think we could have had a successful 89 movie without Tim's insight in hiring Michael Keaton.
Sure.
I think audiences around the world bought the fact that Bruce Wayne was so driven, so obsessed to the point of being psychotic. They said, yeah, that's a guy who would get dressed up as a bat and do this. Mm. And as he once said to me, if he hired a quote unquote serious actor, Harrison Ford, Kevin Costner, Dennis Quaid, he would get those unintentional laughs from the audience when he got right into his bats. So Michael was incredible, and that's what makes the whole thing work. With Christian Bale, I believe what Chris Nolan wanted to do was make the whole, bring back the respect, the dignity, the darkness to Batman. And he was going to do it, though, 180 degrees different than the way Tim Burton did it. He wasn't going to build five square city blocks of Gotham City on the back lot of Pinewood. He was going to make audiences try to believe that this could be a real young man today, post 9/11, it was post-traumatic stress syndrome, on a lost horizon journey of self-discovery through life. He was going to convince the world that the Joker could be relevant in a world that was no longer black and white, that was no longer good versus evil, that was now gray and order versus chaos, and make them believe he was a homicidal maniac, a terrorist. And he did that, and that was scary.
Yeah.
He had to make audiences believe in Gotham City as a real city, and the brilliance of his choosing Chicago and not New York was incredible. You take two iconic buildings out of the skyline of Chicago, most people around the world can't identify the city. Mm. If you're in New York, the second you see Times Square, the Statue of Liberty, boom.
Yeah.
This is on. And then I think his biggest challenge was trying to convince everybody that all the tech and all the gadgets could be real. And there again, the brilliance of a director. He hired a very famous actor to come aboard and tell the audiences, yes, all this technology is very true and it's very real. And by God, when Morgan Freeman tells you something's true, you believe it, it's true. So that was magnificent beyond comprehension. And then Todd's work and Matt Reeves' work. I went back into my files and found from late 89 was my first missive to the studio saying, we need to do a movie focusing on Batman as the world's greatest detective. It took 33 years to get it, and it was worth the wait.
Mm.
Matt Reeves and Robert Pattinson and the whole cast, everybody just did the most phenomenal, phenomenal job. And really reinvented, as you said, Len, reinvented what a comic book movie could be and how Batman could be perceived.
All right, now having accomplished all of that, this is not a trick question. I don't know the answer you're going to give me. Having accomplished all that, have you softened your opinion of the Adam West TV series at all?
Two parts to this answer. Part one, I don't even remember if we were at San Diego Comic-Con or New York. I think it was San Diego Comic-Con. I was scheduled to do a Batman panel with Jerry Robinson, who co-created the Joker and Robin and Alfred. And at the last minute, in this packed room with thousands of people, they said, oh, we've got a last minute addition, Adam West. And Adam came in, sat down next to me. And all right, so now I got to take you back. At the time we announced our first Batman movie, and that we were, this is July 1980 at the Statler Hilton Comic-Con, Phil Swilling's Comic-Con, 1980. First time any movie company ever announced a movie at a comic book convention. Never happened before. At that time, the press went out, and Adam, who I did not know, instead of coming to me or to Warner Brothers or to anyone, he went to the press and started bad-mouthing the movie, saying, no, I need to be Batman. I could be like Uncle Batman, and it needs to be me, and I did it the right way, and these guys are... So the studio got very, very, very upset for a long time. So this is the first time I ever met Adam West in this situation. And what does he do? First thing he does is he grabs the mic and says, ladies and gentlemen, if there's anything I've learned over my career, my lifetime, It's that there's room enough for more than one interpretation of Batman. He said, and while my Batman is my true version, Michael's version is just as valid and just as important. And with that, I turned to him. I said, Adam, will you allow me to let 8-year-old Michael out for a moment? And he said, sure. And I said to the crowd, oh my God, I am sitting next to the Batman of the swinging 60s. And you may have to censor this. I don't know what your rules
are. You're fine, you're fine.
And I turned to Adam and I went, holy shit. The whole place cracked up. He stands up, I stand up, gives me a bear hug, I return it, and all was well with the world. That's part one. Part two, at the time the TV series came out, it was the one and only interpretation around the world of Batman. He was a joke, he was a comedian, and people were laughing. That's what killed me. That's what utterly killed me. Today, it's a completely different story. I embrace it. And I say, what a great avenue for young kids to come into the world of Batman and grow with it, and then grow into the animation, and grow into the movies, and then grow into the video gaming. This has an important place now because it's not the only interpretation. We have Lego Batman. We have animated Batman. We have animated adult Batman. There are so many different Batman versions out there now. We kind of need that, and we kind of need the animated features Batman meets Scooby-Doo. They serve an important purpose today.
Well, that I won't go on for long with this. Jesse will jab me in the elbow if I do. But one result of that incredible phenomenon that was the Adam West TV series, which aired two nights a week on network television. You got two doses of Batman every week. And that the next morning, that's all anyone in school was talking about. I was in junior high school at the time. And that Christmas break, that holiday break, Columbia dug out the 1943 Batman serial, all dreadful 15 chapters, and ran them as a marathon in New York City at the 8th Street Playhouse. And I was among that sold out crowd watching it. And it is just god awful. And it is full of World War II era racist epithets about the Japanese villain, and which I couldn't even repeat here in good conscience. But it was fun. It was an experience. We were all cheering and booing. We were booing the absurdity of it, but loving the experience of it.
Len, I was at the 8th Street Playhouse to watch that for 6.5 hours with my friend Bobby. Mm-hmm. And I think now you were probably sitting like two rows behind.
Probably.
So every time Dr. Daka came on, there were boos coming from behind and somebody was throwing popcorn at the back of my head. I think I now have an answer.
They showed the full credits for every episode. So we watched, you know, the main titles and the cast list. And then it was directed by Spencer Gordon Bennett, who even then was a veteran from the silent film era. And on like chapter 5, some wise guy booed his name and it got a laugh from, you know, the people around. And then by chapter 7, were a handful of people booing his name. By chapter 10, the whole crowd was booing poor Spencer Gordon Bennett, who was just a journeyman doing his job. That's all.
I also remember now, we would sit through this whole episode, and then the next one would come on, and we had to sit through 4 minutes of a summary of what we had just seen.
That's right. The recap, exactly.
Yeah.
As if 1 week had gone by.
Two people in the crowd overdosed on popcorn that day. Had to rush to a hospital.
All right. So let's go backwards now to approximately 8-year-old Michael Uslan. I got hooked on movies. You got hooked on comic books. And which ones appeal to you the most?
As a kid, I read and collected everything. Superheroes, of course, were number one. But I read Archie. I read Casper. I read Richie Rich until as an adult, I finally figured out, oh, my God, this is Donald Trump in short pants. And I stopped reading it. I read Classics Illustrated. I read all, Disney comics, Looney Tunes comics, Walter Lantz comics. Little Archie, Big Archie, all the little comic book groups and Dell, you name it, I consumed everything. So by the time I graduated high school, I had over 30,000 comic books dating back to 1936.
Oh,
and it filled my parents' garage. My dad never once got his car in the garage.
And they never threw them away?
No. You know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. So when I was started reading comics and collecting them, Frederick Wortham had put his book out, Seduction of the Innocent. With only two other exceptions, none of my other friends were allowed to read comics by their parents. They had to do so on the sly. It was a very subversive thing, reading comic books back then. And except for the three of us, nobody else was allowed to bring a comic book into their home. So luckily, my mom sat down and she read them. And she said to me, there's nothing wrong with these. I think they are increasing your vocabulary and they're sparking your imagination. So here's the deal. You can keep reading and collecting all you want, but you have to keep them neat. And you must promise me you'll also read newspapers, magazines, and books. And that was the greatest deal I ever made in my life.
I would say a fair and square deal.
Well, it is funny to listen. You guys are probably almost the same age, and
I think
your
I'm
parents,
older.
You are? And my dad's 71.
Oh, I'm 71 too.
See, you're twins, 1950. Yeah. He's a pure boomer.
Ah, okay. 51. So you just barely got me.
That's one. But his parents, similarly, they didn't mind that he couldn't work with the sports and didn't want to really go outside. And he loved movies and they encouraged it and they let him do that. It's amazing to me what can be accomplished. You two are like the poster children.
Well, yeah.
What can be accomplished if you approach something in a way, you know, that.
Obviously, Michael and I both chose our parents well.
Yes.
Now, how did this evolve into teaching a course?
Okay. So I grew up the comic book geek. I lived an hour outside of New York City. So any Tuesday afternoon off from school, I would beg my mom to take me and my friend Bobby up to the DC comic book tour on Tuesdays. And I got to meet a lot of the artists and writers. I got to learn a bit about the histories. And I went to the first big Comic-Con held when I was 13 in a Fleabag hotel, the Broadway Central in downtown New York. And there were 200 of us at that Comic-Con, 197 guys and three girls. and I was amazed there were three girls, one of which I'm going to have lunch with next week at San Diego Comic-Con, Maggie Thompson.
Oh, wonderful, Maggie. Yes.
And it was a magical experience. I learned then that the comic book companies were all based in New York.
Yeah.
Pretty much. That all the creators of the superheroes since the 30s, most of them, lived in New York, New Jersey, or Long Island. And my poor dad, he worked 6 days a week as a stonemason, and he would give up his Sundays and drive me to their homes. I would arrange to interview them and to meet with them. First one was Otto Binder. Otto created the Marvel family. He created Mary Marvel, Captain Marvel Jr., Black Adam. Then he went to DC where he created Supergirl, the Legion of Superheroes, Crypto the Superdog, and Brainiac. I spent 10 hours that day with Otto Binder at his home in Englewood. And Otto became my first mentor. He opened up the golden age to me and it told me how the industry started, how DC and Marvel started, how these characters were created and why, and what the behind the scenes were. It was miraculous, absolutely miraculous. And he put me in touch with C.C. Beck, the co-creator of Captain Marvel. Starting in seventh grade, I had a weekly correspondence with him. So I got all the history straight from the horse's mouth. So this was my passion. And as my dad used to say, he loved what he did with bricks and stones. And for him, it was not like work 6 days a week. He was an old world artist. He was a real craftsman. And he said, you got to find your bricks and stones. And I realized it was for me, comic books and movies and animation. And that's what I needed to do in life. And very specifically, Batman came to the forefront. And that's what started me. So when I got to college, and I was always looking away to get my foot in any cracked open door, when I heard that Indiana said, if you have an idea for a course that's never been taught before and could get the backing of a department on campus, you could then pitch it to the dean. And if he approves it, even though I was an undergrad, I could teach it on campus for 3 hours of credit. So I wrote a syllabus for comic books. They're a legitimate American art form, as indigenous to this country as jazz. Comic book superheroes are a modern day mythology. The ancient gods of Greece, Rome, and Egypt all still exist today, only they wear spandex and capes. The psychological impact of comics on its audience, comics as literature, comics and education. And I got the backing of the folklore department. Professor Henry Glassie said to me, he said, so what's your pitch? Why do you think they're mythology? And I simply said this. I said, the Greeks called him Hermes. The Romans called him Mercury. I call him the Flash. The Greeks called him Poseidon. The Romans called him Neptune. I call him Aquaman. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, you're right. It's the same conventional stock characters, same plots, same motifs. I don't care if they're called King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table or the Avengers. I'm in. I will back you. And that's when I got to appear before the dean, who took one look at me walking in with my hair down to my shoulders, a Spider-Man t-shirt, comic books under my arm, and my hippie love beads. And he said, so you're the fellow who wants to teach a course on funny books at my university? And that's how my first pitch began. And the core, Len, that day, he rejected me outright. He only let me speak for 2 minutes. He says, come on, give me a break. He goes, I read comic books when I was a little boy. I read every issue of Superman I could get my hands on. But all they are cheap entertainment for little children, nothing more, nothing less, and I reject your theory. So at this point, if I had bowed my head, picked up my funny books and walked out, my life would have been done and you would be talking to a lawyer today.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, figuring I had nothing to lose, I decided to stand my ground. And I said, Dean, may I ask you 2 questions? He said, ask me anything you want. I said, are you familiar with the story of Moses? And he looked at me like I was nuts. He says, yeah, so? I said, so Dean, very, very briefly, could you just summarize the story of Moses for me? And he sits back in his chair and he goes, I don't know what kind of game you're playing here, but I'll play this with you. The Hebrew people were being persecuted. Their firstborn were being slain. Hebrew couple placed their infant son in a little wicker basket, send him down the River Nile. There he's discovered by an Egyptian family who raise him as their own son. When he grows up and learns of his true heritage, he becomes a great hero to his people. But I said, stop. Dean, that was great. Thanks. You said before you read Superman when you were a kid. By any chance, you remember the origin of Superman? He says, sure. The planet Krypton was going to blow up. A scientist and his wife place their infant son in a little rocket ship and send him to Earth. There he's discovered by the Kents. And then he stops, stares at me for an eternity and says, your course is accredited. And I am now the world's first college professor of comic books. And that's the step that got me in the door, that brought me to the attention of Stan Lee and Saul Harrison at DC Comics, that led me to writing The Shadow and then Batman, that led me to win the confidence of the folks at DC. So a kid in his 20s could show up and buy the rights to make dark and serious Batman movies. It's all very unglamorous. And it is the subject. This is the story of my Broadway play, The Boy Who Loved Batman.
I'm trying to play this right.
First of all, I'm just going to pause for a second because you two have very similar origin stories yourself. this one was teaching about animation in New York when that was not a thing people were doing. And he was at the New School. He had a class and folks like Jerry Beck, who is still one of his best friends, took that class. That's how they met. And this is the thing. I try to say this to people all the time. If you really love something and it is your passion, be smart about it. Figure out how you can get to those interviews, like what you're talking about, this one would use the phone book and he would call people. He
the Manhattan phone directory.
He would call. Oh, yeah. And as a child, I still can't get over how young he was, as a kid would go and interview these people when he was 14, 15 years old. Same thing. If you love something and you want it to be what you do, you have to show people that you are smart, that you really care, and that you're going to do something with it. Because when those people meet you, they want to become your mentor. Because if they see in you what they felt themselves, they will be inclined to give you everything. With that, you just mentioned that you have a play, a Broadway play.
But before we get there, you just opened the door to two more things. And I know we're going off on tangents. I met Jerry Beck for the first time at Jerry Olinger's movie material store in the Village.
Yep.
Which I bet you hung out at some point in time.
You guys must have passed each other, honestly.
I know.
We must have passed each other.
We certainly occupied the same space at some time.
Yeah.
We certainly occupy the same psychic space.
Yeah, that's right.
No question about it. And just further to your thing about the Manhattan phone book, Fantastic Four number 9 came out, where the Fantastic Four are evicted from the Baxter building. They've gone bankrupt. And I said to my mom, me and my friend Bobby, we want to go into New York and see the Baxter building. And my mom took us to New York to see the Baxter building. So we're walking around Midtown. Nobody knows where it is. She asks the cop says he doesn't know. So she goes to this thing called a phone booth that I don't know if any of your listeners would know, and picks up this book with pages that some are yellow and some are white. And she calls Marvel Comics, and she, Flo Steinberg, who was Stan Lee's assistant, answers the phone. And she said, I have these boys here and we're looking for the Baxter building. We can't find them. So I thought I'd call Marvel. And she said, oh, Mrs. Uslin, I'm so sorry, but the Baxter building was just a creation of Stan and Jack Kirby and it's not real. And my mother goes, oh my gosh, these boys are going to be brokenhearted. She goes, well, I've taken them on the DC tour. May I come up to Marvel and take them on the Marvel tour? And she says, oh, Mrs. Uslin, we're so much smaller than DC. We really don't do tours. And my mother said, well, I've got two heartbroken kids. We drove all the way from New Jersey to come to New York City. And so Flo says, well, you know what? We're at 655 Madison Avenue. Bring the boys up. I'll take them around. We go up there. I'm 11 years old, Len. And she introduced me to Stan Lee and Jack Kirby.
Wow.
And I had my oldest comic book, All Winners number 18, and they autographed it for me. And that was it. I did not have another conversation with Stan until the phone call when I was teaching the class.
Hmm. Well, what can I say? I mean, you know,
I swear to God, you must have passed each other. This is the you had a Bobby, he had a Lewis Black. Lewis Black is one of the guys who started South by Southwest. That Lewis?
Wait a minute. Lewis Black lived by Otto Binder. He was close to Otto Binder.
Yes,
when
he
I
was.
When I went up to Otto's, he introduced me to Lewis Black. We swapped comic books. I gave him some of mine to read. He still has my Action number 17 and my Leading Comics 7. I've known Lewis Black since I was 13.
Literally, that's his brother. That's one of his best. Really, we call him. That's his brother. They used to go. It was him and Lewis who went to find Buster Keaton when they saw that Buster Keaton was going to be filming in the city. They went.
I had a regular correspondence with Buster Keaton. I met him at the Comic-Con in New York City. He was living in Rye, New York, and not Rye, New York, but no, Buster Crabbe.
Buster Crabbe.
Oh, Buster Crabbe. Buster
Crabbe. That
was Buster Crabbe. Oh, yes. My God. Buster Crabbe.
Buster
Most
Crabbe.
Handsome. See, and same thing. My dad wrote letters. He wrote letters to people. He still has all of his correspondence. He saved everything. He would write back and forth. This is what they would do.
Yeah.
Swear to God, you're the same person.
You know, he is now, we'll table this by saying that he is now Dr. Lewis Black.
Yes.
He completed his PhD on Jonathan Demme and is now Dr. Lewis Black.
Incredible.
Big things none of us ever thought were possible.
Wow.
But that's, wow. Oh my God.
Jonathan Demme did Last Embrace.
Yes.
I was the lawyer at United Artists who did negotiated his contract and the contracts with everybody on that picture and was in charge of all the legal business and financial affairs on that thing. Roy Scheider, Janet Margolin, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Now, all right. How did you get involved with Swamp Thing?
Oh, my God. Okay. Swamp Thing. I had just made the deal to buy the rights to Batman. And it quickly became apparent as every studio turned me down. Every single studio laughed me at it or kicked me out of their office. Every mini major turned me down. I knew this is going to be a longer process than I thought. I had just quit my job at United Artists. I gave up my pension. I gave up my bonus. I gave up my medical and dental plan. I had no security. I had a wife who was 9.2 months pregnant, and we were building our first house. So I said to my partner, Ben Melnicker, we need something really quick and fast. So I went back to Warner DC and I said, I want to buy the rights to Swamp Thing. Now, the person who was I had to deal with was a high up exec, way above the pay grade of even the president of DC Comics. And he said, and they were at that point, they were generally embarrassed that they had even bought a comic book company. The only reason I was told point blank they bought DC was to get their hands on Superman, because they felt that was the only IP that had the potential to be made into a blockbuster movie. Batman had no value, Wonder Woman, no value, Marvel, no value. So they really looked down their nose at the comic book field. So I said, I want to buy the rights to Swamp Thing. And he looked at me, he goes, Swamp Thing? DC publishes something ridiculous? Swamp Thing? I don't believe you. I said, yeah, actually, it's won awards. He goes, wait a minute. He leaves the room, comes back. He says, well, we did publish it, but it was recently canceled. And I said, well, if you give me the rights, I'll make a movie about it. We'll rebuild the franchise and they'll publish it again. It won't be an asset lying, gathering dust in a library. He goes, DC will never publish that again. That's just ridiculous. And he goes, don't you understand? That has like no value. And I said, well, you're right. It has no value. So give it to me for free. I said, if you give it to me for free, I will, in writing, guarantee that I will spend $15,000 of my own money developing it for a movie. He said, you would put up 15, this is like 79. You would put up $15,000 of your own money? Yeah, I will. He says, all right, you can have it for free, but you have to put up $15,000. I already knew I had Wes Craven interested. And I knew I could go back to my alma mater, United Artists, who loved Wes Craven. They had the foreign rights to all of his early movies. So I made a deal. I got half the money from United Artists. Ben knew the president of AFCO Embassy Pictures, Bob Ramey, really well. Went to Bob Ramey, goes, I love Wes Craven. You get Wes Craven, we'll put up half for domestic. So I already knew we had it.
Wow.
And that's how it started. But I will add one thing, which I already revealed in my book. Under that contract, we were given all rights to Swamp Thing. Not that we were given the movie rights. We became the literary property owner of Swamp Thing, with DC only reserving comic book publishing, and we would split merchandising. As a result, we had the rights to, we owned anything created or appearing in Swamp Thing comics. Thus, I got for free John Constantine Hellblazer. What was that character? The Patchwork Man. I wound up owning 11 DC characters.
Now, what is your favorite Swamp Thing tchotchke?
My favorite Swamp Thing. Well, the sneakers were pretty cool.
Oh, my God.
The slippers had little Swamp Thing heads on them. The lunchbox I took to work for about a year. It was all that stuff. We had a master toy license with Kenner, which was great. And then we wound up doing we made two Swamp Thing movies. The second one, they wanted us to reposition it as a kid's property. Which worked because it got us a deal with Universal and USA Network for a live-action Swamp Thing series. Simultaneously, when we had that, we went to Fox Kids and we sold the simultaneous animated series to them. Nobody got any merchandising. Ben and I kept it all and split it with DC. And for 10 years, the Swamp Thing merchandising money paid for our entire office overhead. I mean, it was pretty amazing.
And that, and we didn't actually underscore this point, but it took you 10 years to get that Batman movie, that first Batman movie made, right?
It did. It did, because I was turned down by everybody.
Right.
Real quickly, the last studio I wound up at, the project had stalled dramatically. And this was a couple of years later. So we thought maybe we could get the rights back and set it up at someplace else where we would get traction. So Ben set up a meeting for us at Columbia. And I pitched my heart out to one of their longtime, old-time production execs. He and Ben went back to 1940 together, I think. And I pitched my heart out about the dark and serious Batman. And he says to me, Michael, you're crazy. Batman will never be successful as a movie because our new movie, Annie, hasn't done well.
Obviously.
So I said, wait a minute, are you talking about the little redheaded girl from Broadway who sings Tomorrow? He said, yeah. I go, well, what does that have to do with Batman?
Yeah.
Oh, come on, Michael. They're both out of the funny pages.
Oh, God.
It was just like the Dean. That was my rejection. And that's what we were facing. That's what we were facing at the time.
Though now I would very much like a movie about Annie and Batman. That would be
the scene you will see in the play.
Okay.
and a few others like it. It was a crazy, crazy time for me, but I was dealing with a generation of executives and agents who were adults during the Wortham era, who bought it hook, line, and sinker. They believed comic books were at best cheap entertainment for little children and at worst harmful.
Right.
And that's who I was dealing with. And they had no respect for characters or their creators. Mm. And that's something I wanted to rectify. My mission in life and in my career became my life was not only to bring respect and dignity to Batman, but to bring respect and dignity to Otto Binder and Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster and Bill Finger and Jerry Robinson and all these creators that did this massive work and were denigrated. They were degraded. They struggled. They were humiliated. And I wanted to bring honor and respectability. And today, their works are hanging in major museums, galleries, universities. And where a lot of the guys I dealt with didn't make it long enough to see it, their kids did, and their grandkids did, and their great-grandkids are. And that is just as important to me in my career as what we did with Batman.
Well, you're certainly not resting on your laurels.
Yeah, right.
you've got so many irons in the fire, Michael. And as we're winding down, what is it you'd like to plug? We'll give you your choice.
Yeah, right.
Tell us.
Which of your 17 things would you like to plug?
This is great. Stan always told me, Michael, when they give you an opening, go for it. Plug everything you can plug. My memoir is The Boy Who Loved Batman, which is now available on audiobook also. My sequel memoir came out in March when our movie The Batman opened. It's called Batman's Batman. And the audiobook version of that is now available through Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, yada, yada, yada. The Broadway play will be announcing officially next Saturday night at San Diego Comic-Con. So that's like the most exciting thing that I'm doing. Warner Brothers has already announced Joker 2 is coming through the genius of Todd Phillips, and so many other things that are fun. And I'm producing with my son, David. We've got three new streaming series we are in the middle of negotiations for that we're very excited about. And lastly, I'll mention that David and I were brought in by Genius Brands, and we are now overseeing the Stan Lee legacy for them. They control the name, likeness, signature, all the rights to Stan Lee. And we are making sure that something great happens. And we're all going to be celebrating Stan's centennial birthday later this year.
Can I tell you, my dad interviewed Stan not long before he passed away, mm-hmm. and he signed a poster for my husband. My husband loves all of this. This is his thing. And he signed a poster for my husband, you know, to Super Scott. And that was such a generous, he didn't have to do that, you know, but whenever you saw him, he gave everyone time and he understood what he meant to people. And, you know, when I see him appear in all the various Marvel films, you know, when they stick him in, it brings me great joy. And, you know that what you're doing now for him and for his legacy, it's important because he was exactly the fanboy that inspired people because he was a fanboy and proudly so, you know? Yeah.
Very, very final anecdote because you brought it up. Stan was always on me. He goes, Michael, I want to do a cameo in a DC movie.
Of course he does.
He goes, ask Chris Nolan if I could do it. I said, Stan, Chris is trying to do the most realistic Batman right. of all. I don't think it's going to fit. He goes, well, go ahead and ask him. Just go ahead and ask him. So I talked to Chris. Chris laughs. He goes, I'd love to help the old guy, but, you know, I'm trying to make this realistic. When Stan was in his last months, I had lunch one day with Sam Register, the wonderful president of Warner Animation. And we, at that time, we were doing Teen Titans Go to the Movies. And we're at lunch, and I said, you know, Stan's not doing well. He always wanted to do a cameo in a DC movie, and it's just, it kills me that we weren't able to do it. He goes, do you think he'd do a cameo in an animated DC movie?
Absolutely.
I go, yeah. He says, well, we're locking this movie on Friday. Do you think he would do a cameo in Teen Titans Go to the Movies? I said, I don't think, I know it. Mm-hmm. I said, wait a minute. I stepped outside, I called Stan. Stan said, I'll do it. He said, but I'm not well, they'll have to come to me. I said, Sam, can you bring equipment to Stan? He goes, we'll do it.
Yeah.
Within 4 days.
Amazing.
He had the animators create the avatar. He had Amazing. The writers write like 10 different lines. And Stan wound up doing 2 animated cameos in Teen Titans Go to the Movies right before he passed away.
That's fantastic.
And they're fabulous. They're fabulous.
That's fantastic.
And bravo you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. I love that.
So this has been awesome, guys. I've loved every second of this.
Oh, well, we have two. And since this is via the magic of delayed podcast, used to say broadcast, now we say podcast. We'll see you in San Diego.
That's right.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you for being our guest.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You know, the thing about fandom, right? There's good and there's bad. We know what the bad stuff is. The good stuff is that you meet other people who inspire you to embrace what you love and do what you love, whatever that may be, because frankly, it just makes your life better. As simple as it may sound, when you do things that you love, it makes it all better. And I love that you guys know the same people. I swear you must have been in the same room.
That is so funny.
That's crazy. We're gonna call Lewis.
Oh, nuts. My.
Oh gosh. Well, all right. Well, I know you're gonna get into one of your fun little
No.
You're just gonna go for it?
Jesse, how do people find us?
Oh, well, you are at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. You're also on Facebook. We have our YouTube channel, Maltin on Movies. We do a weekly live stream on Sundays. You can watch that there. And of course, the Patreon, the Maltreon.
Patreon is where you can help support us to make sure we can keep doing what we're doing. And we have various ways of thanking you, including a subscription to the columns that I write every month, mm-hmm. which are available only to Patreon contributors.
That's right.
So go to patreon.com/Maltin on Movies. patreon.com/Maltin on Movies. And other than that, we're going to say goodbye for now.
See you next week.
Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.